From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzek Werlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to Worldviews. Today marks 50 years since President John F. Kennedy died by an assassin's hand in Dallas. University of Oklahoma political scientist Charles Kenny joins me to discuss Kennedy's global legacy, especially in Latin America.
It's not coincidental that within a month of one another, he both launched the Alliance for Progress and he launched the attack on Cuba known as the Bay of Pigs.
And later, I'll talk with film producer Michael Kovit. His documentary, 333, tells the story of the ancient manuscripts of Mali.
Most of us have trouble forgiving, so I thought it was a roadmap of peace for the entire world.
Centuries-old West African methods of conflict resolution. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Werlot. Charlie Kenny, thank you for joining me for the roundtable today to mark the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. During his short term in office, he did experience some significant international challenges, everything from, of course, the growing conflict in Vietnam and the building of the Berlin Wall and tensions with the Soviet Union. But also in Latin America, these experiences with the, you know, Bay of Pigs, the attempted overthrow of Castro, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But at the same time, he also experienced some significant success in the international arena. He created the Peace Corps. He created the Alliance for Progress, which had a significant impact on Latin America as well. So, Charlie, given your background and experience in that part of the world, tell us what you think about the short term that President Kennedy had in office and how he was received by that community, and particularly these challenges and successes that he experienced there.
I think that we can see the Kennedy presidency and its legacy in Latin America through the eyes of one quote, if you will, from a speech he gave in 1962.
Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable.
He believed that communism was a great evil, and he believed that the United States had a role in the world in combating communism wherever it could. And he sought to do so in two ways, through what we might call soft power today and by creating conditions in Latin America that would be less propitious for communist subversion, as they would have referred to it at that time, but also using the various means the United States has at its disposal to fight communism and communist dictators where they were found. It's not coincidental that within a month of one another, he both launched the Alliance for Progress, a massive development program for Latin America, and he launched the attack on Cuba, the unsuccessful attack on Cuba known as the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was a plan inherited from the Eisenhower administration but that he approved of. In neither case were the programs successful. The Bay of Pigs was a fiasco. It did more probably to harm the image of the United States in Latin America than many other things combined, and more to ensure that Castro would remain in power. The Alliance for Progress was more of a mixed success. It did not achieve its goals, but it did convey a new image of the United States to Latin America, one in which the United States highlighted the problems of social injustice in Latin America and prioritized changes in Latin American politics and economics that would greatly change the status of the lower class people in Latin America. And it's, I think, for that reason, along with his youthful energy, his Catholicism, that he became much beloved in Latin America.
So despite some of these significant failures and challenges he faced, today he's remembered very fondly. So what is the image? Let's end that with that discussion. What is the image of John F. Kennedy today when people in Latin America think back about his presidency and their experiences with him?
I think for the general public in Latin America, it's much like that of the United States. He is an image of youthful hope, of ideals, of the things that we would all like to stand for and see happen in the world. And for that reason, there are more parks and schools and streets and things named for Kennedy than any other U.S. president in Latin America. In many homes in the 1960s, there were photos of him on the wall next to a photo of Jesus Christ or something like that. Not a photo of Jesus Christ, a painting or something like that, images. So I think he's remembered rather fondly.
Well, Charlie, it's a sad day, of course, to remember these sorts of things, but it's very interesting to see what a person such as John F. Kennedy, a person who was whose presidency was cut so short, the significant impact that he had around the world, and particularly in our own hemisphere in Latin America. So, Charlie, yeah. Thank you for joining me today to remember President Kennedy.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments, let us know on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Gralat. You can also leave your thoughts on our website, kgou.org. Coming up, I'll talk with film producer Michael Kovit about his documentary 333 and what lessons from centuries-old manuscripts in Mali can be applied to the insurgency in the northern part of the country. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. For the last 2 years, armed conflict has torn the African nation of Mali apart, with Islamist rebels making strong gains in the northern half of the country. Mali was once one of the most wealthy and peaceful nations on earth, and an intellectual and cultural hub of West Africa. My guest, Michael Kovit, is the founder of the Malian Manuscript Foundation. He produced a documentary film that tells the story of thousands of manuscripts preserved in Timbuktu. Michael Kovit, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thank you so very much, Suzette. I appreciate it.
Well, you've produced a very interesting documentary called 333. Where does the name of this documentary come from?
Well, it comes from the city of Timbuktu, which is known as the city of 333 saints, which are buried there. The focus on the film is on Mali and specifically the ancient manuscripts of Mali, which were actually written during the 12th through 16th centuries when Mali was the wealthiest nation in the world.
So an African nation that today doesn't really bear any resemblance to that. It's not the wealthiest nation in the world. And
no,
yet
was
one of the poorest
now.
It's one of the poorest nations in the world now and yet has this tremendous rich background in history. And so these ancient manuscripts that teach us what?
Pretty much every subject under the sun. During the 12th through 16th centuries, when they were the world's wealthiest nation, they controlled two-thirds of the world's gold supply, the trading in slaves and trading in salt. They were also the learning center for the entire world, specifically for Islam. Scholars came from as far away as Spain, Portugal, Persia, and these scholars would stay. And they would write their own manuscripts about pretty much any subject you can think of, including women's rights, children's rights, and animal rights. But our particular interest was the peaceful resolution of conflict through dialogue, tolerance, understanding, and forgiveness.
So these are ancient manuscripts that come out of this part of the world, but that seems to be very inconsistent with the narrative we have today about Mali and about countries like Mali. So what took you there? I mean, the story obviously took you there, but what motivated you to go and tell this story? And what are you trying to get out of telling this story in terms of what we can learn from these ancient manuscripts?
Well, we had a global security consulting practice. And we were looking at the world and knew the world was in a lot of trouble. Countries are land masses surrounded by borders, owned and controlled by individuals, generally referred to as church and state. What usually happens historically is the church and state take from the people go broke, there's a revolution, the hands change, and the same thing happens all over again in different hands. The problem is when countries grow old, they also become financially bankrupt. Guess what? Their citizens become ethically and morally corrupt. And when that happens, you see some very strange things. And before countries go under, and they always go under for the same reason, which is their inability to pay their debt, they always do the same thing, which is they usually go to war. And the reason you go to war is because if you control the land or you own the land, you control all the wealth on that land, and wealth which meaning all material objects devised by mankind for the satisfaction of human desire comes from the land. It comes by adding human energy to the land. So leaders tend to know that. When they get in this position, not being able to pay their debt, they usually go to war. The problem with today is everybody has weapons of mass destruction. And I learned about the peaceful resolution of conflict through dialogue, tolerance, understanding, and forgiveness that they've been practicing in Mali for centuries now, and it seems to work. Most of us have trouble forgiving. So I thought it was a roadmap of peace for the entire world.
I'm speaking with Michael Kovit, a documentary filmmaker and the founder of the Malian Manuscript Foundation. We'll talk about how to reconcile Mali's peaceful past with its violent present in the second half of our show. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guest, Michael Kovit, produced a documentary last year that tells the story of Mali's ancient manuscripts and what lessons they offer about the peaceful resolution of conflict, especially with the country's violent recent history. So your objective was to highlight our history so that we could hope, in this case, to repeat it.
They're actually following it today still. I mean, it's amazing. Since January last year, there was an insurgency formed by MNLA, which is the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad. Azawad is the northern part of Mali, which is the size of France. And when they were kids, they were Tuaregs living in Mali, and their families, you know, parents making less than $1 a day, they found a great way to make money, so they went to Libya to work for Gaddafi's mercenaries. And when Gaddafi died, they stole all of his armaments, including all of his ammunition. They went across 1,000 miles, 3 different countries, with 17 trucks, 5 different times with weapons, somehow evading U.S. satellite surveillance. And then they teamed up with AQIM, which is a al-Qaeda in the Muslim Maghreb, which is basically drug dealers and kidnappers, and a group called Ansadim, which is an Islamist group. And they beat the Malian army in every skirmish. And the Malian army was 6,000. These guys were under 1,000. But the Malian army was trained by U.S. Special Forces. But the president of Mali, who was basically, I think, a good guy, maybe a little corrupt, but a good guy, did not arm his soldiers properly because he didn't want to kill his own people. So they wound up being a coup d'etat. And after the coup d'etat, these other three groups took the north, or the three capital cities in the north, Kidal, Gao, and Timbuktu, on a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday. And Timbuktu, which was the global music center of the world for world music, all of a sudden you're no longer allowed to hear music on radio. And it was pretty much the only tourist city in all of Mali, so it was a strange thing to happen. And the mess just started getting worse and worse.
So the French then intervened. Mali is a former French colony, of course.
French came in January this year.
Right, and helped to liberate the north and return this territory to the Malian government.
It's a little more complicated than that. The French sponsored a resolution in the United Nations, which became ratified to go in and liberate Mali from the insurgency. Everybody waited for the United States, and President – I'm trying to pronounce his name – Hollande. You know, I don't think you pronounce the H over there.
Hollande, yeah.
He decided to go without waiting for everybody. He brought in a couple thousand people and then – planes and dropped some bombs, and he chased them into the desert, and they were living under the desert. They were prepared for this. They had oil and vehicles and weapons sitting in the desert, and they were waiting for the French to leave. So, but before that actually happened, Ansadine had a fight with MNLA in the Battle of Gao. And MNLA, which started the whole thing in the first place, bringing all those weapons into the country, they got chased out of the country. So the French, looking apparently victorious, left 1,000 troops. They were up to 4,000, and that is a force of 12,000 of United Nations peacekeepers in there. But peacekeepers may not be enough because after the coup d'etat, that wound up eventually being an election, and they now have President Kita in office. And one of the first things he did was hire a guy by the name of Captain Sonogo, who's the guy who started the coup d'etat. And he went from captain to either three- or four-star general in a couple of days, depending upon which publication you believe. And MNLA is now back in Mali's north. And during the election in the major city of Kidal, there were only 35 registered voters up in the north, and only one voted, and I think because they were intimidated by MNLA. So I don't know that the war is over yet.
So by telling this story of the history of Mali and its presence as a democratic state in Africa for many, many years, that this is more of an accurate portrayal of Muslim society in the continent and in the region and is really a roadmap. We should look to Mali as an example, despite the fact that we have obviously this very troubling situation going on in Mali right now. I mean, it's, you know, so trying to reconcile these two different perspectives on the country and on the region.
Mali, before all of this happened in January of last year, was 90% Muslim and a very, very peaceful country. I felt safe wherever I went, despite the fact that people pointed guns at me. I didn't feel nervous because you can look in their eyes and you knew they weren't about to hurt you. They just figured you look suspicious when you're driving around in five vehicles. And the manuscripts are actually written in an Arabic and Hebrew, which is interesting. There's Hebrew in the margins. And we had examined a group of Tuaregs who were scholars known as ambassadors of peace. The ambassadors teach the wisdom from the manuscripts that were brought down from generation to generation by their families. And every day before the sun rises, they sit in something called a circle of knowledge and they impart their wisdom. And they made it unequivocally clear that if you kill yourself or you kill anybody else, you not only don't get into heaven, but you go directly into hellfire. And we had that ratified by scholars here in the United States, too. It's a lot of very bright talking heads talking about peace.
But it's an interesting commentary when you say that these manuscripts are written in, from an Islamic perspective, but yet, you know, written in Arabic, but Hebrew notations, that it's also some sort of lesson. It seems to me that your film provides some sort of lesson of interfaith dialogue and cooperation and community that Mali apparently represents, or it did historically.
There are churches next to synagogues, next to mosques in Mali. And the lost tribe of Jews still lives in Mali. It's an interesting, peaceful place. With all the wars and all the insurgencies, before the French came, I think less than 200 people died by my count. After the French, maybe another 800. Any other country in the world would be 30, 40,000 people. And they tend to forgive each other, which is really astonishing. I don't know if the forgiveness is going to be complete yet, because when MNLA came to help their brothers, they wound up raping some of their brothers' wives, and that angered a lot of people, and I don't know how easily that gets forgiven. But in our movie, we show an example of somebody whose father was killed, and they asked him to forgive them, and he did, and he came back to Mali.
So the story, basically, the moral of the story is forgiveness and the history that they have to forgive one another in order to overcome these very real differences.
Well, forgiveness is a big part of it because it's the most difficult for all of us. But it's the peaceful resolution of conflict through dialogue, tolerance, understanding and forgiveness. You ought to have a dialogue before you get the forgiving, because if you don't have the dialogue – that full forgiveness may just not be there.
So do you have much hope that Mali can overcome its current troubles and find its way back to
I have more hope for Mali than I do for the world.
But Mali, therefore, is an example, is what you're telling us. It's an example of what we should be.
They do practice a peaceful resolution of conflict. You know, there are wars there like there is in any other place. But for some reason or other, they come to an abrupt stop and they forgive and they actually forget. And they move on. What has happened that precipitated all these insurgencies, I believe, is every time that they come to a peaceful resolution of conflict with the government, that's the Tuaregs, the government promises them something, but it never gets there. And I believe President Tuareg, who promised them $2 million the last time, sent it out, but who knows whose pocket it got in.
So you mentioned corruption, obviously, is still
there is corruption
problem.
In every country in the world, including Mali.
Yeah.
It's pretty prevalent in that part of the world, actually.
So how does that square with the peaceful resolution of conflict and forgiveness to be corrupt?
You know, I think when it becomes a way of life, it almost becomes okay. Not okay with me, but they forgive that. It's no big thing.
Forgive the corruption.
They forgive the corruption. They forgive killing. It's an amazing group of people. We don't know what's going to happen with MNLA because they and Answer Dean are the unknowns. And when I say the unknowns, MNLA had an accord with the government. They signed an accord. And the new president, after he took office, which was last week, he got sworn in. He has 60 days to meet with them. And there was a skirmish between some soldiers and MNLA. MNLA is a little different than the rest of the Malians in that area because they worked for Gaddafi and they learned how to drive, shoot, and kill. So it makes them a different set of people. You know, once you cross that border and you start killing people, all of a sudden you have a different spirit.
Well, and the crossing of borders is what we're seeing a lot in this region now.
Yes.
So, well, Michael Kovit, thank you so much for joining us and telling us this very interesting story and really enlightening us as to a different vision or a different view of Mali than what many of us see in the daily newspapers.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Michael Kovit, a film producer and the chairman of the Malian Manuscript Foundation. You can watch the trailer for his documentary, 333, by visiting the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews, and our broadcast producer is Brian Hardzinski. For Charles Kenny, I'm Suzette Grelott.